The next case on the court's calendar is Kimbrough versus State of Minnesota. We're ready for arguments from appellant's counsel. Please introduce yourself for the record before beginning your argument.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Eriksson, and I represent Mr. Kimbrough this morning. We are requesting that this court reverse the district court's order and remand so Mr. Kimbrough can file a petition with the district court to establish that he is entitled to relief under the Act of May 19, 2023. The purpose of the preliminary application process is to filter out applicants who were not convicted of aiding and abetting felony murder or who were no longer in custody or on supervision. The purpose is not for the district court to conduct its own investigation into the facts of the case and rule on the merits of the request for relief. The plain language of the Act supports this conclusion. First, the legislature's stated purpose within Subdivision 1 is that any applicant convicted of aiding and abetting felony murder who is in custody or on supervised release is entitled to petition the court for relief. Second, the legislature stated reasons that a district court can deny a preliminary application within Subdivision 5 do not include a finding that the applicant was a major participant or acted with extreme indifference to human life.
Let's get right into the statute, because this is a new statute. It's unfamiliar to many of us, and I think raises many questions. Regarding the preliminary application, subparagraph C requires the reviewing judge to determine whether, in that judge's discretion, there's a reasonable probability that the applicant is entitled to relief. So your reading of reasonable probability would be that that simply means he was convicted of the necessary offense and he's in custody. If so, there's a reasonable probability that he's entitled to relief.
That's correct.
You don't go to, you don't go beyond that.
That's absolutely correct.
But then why, in paragraph D, does it say, in making the determination under paragraph C, that is, whether there's a reasonable probability that the applicant is entitled to relief, the reviewing judge shall consider the preliminary application, any material submitted with it, and may consider relevant records in the possession of the judicial branch. If all the judge needs to find for a reasonable probability is that he was convicted of aiding and abetting and that he's in custody, why this permission to consider other relevant records in the possession of the judicial branch?
Yeah, a couple reasons, Your Honor. First, so when an individual submits a preliminary application, a lot of them are in prison. They fill out a form, they submit it with the court. There's nothing included with that. So the judge has to determine.
Let me stop there, because that's another interesting thing with this statute. Preliminary application must contain, here it is, a brief statement not to exceed 3,000 words explaining why the applicant is entitled to relief under this section from a conviction for the death of a human being caused by another. And I know that such a statement was submitted. According to you, that statement would say nothing more than I've been convicted of aiding and abetting and I'm in custody.
That's correct. And if I could just take a step back.
Sure.
So as far as the other materials that the court can consider, we've been handling these from the Public Defender's Office all over the state of Minnesota. And there are a lot of cases where somebody was convicted of aiding and abetting felony murder in the early 90s or late 80s. And if you go on Minsis or anywhere else, there's no record of, sometimes in these cases, of what the individual was actually convicted of. It might say 609.185. It might include 609.05. So the court can look in their records and say, well, he was actually convicted of under accomplice liability, so we're going to allow him to proceed. And that's the discretionary issue, is in some of these cases, it is impossible for the applicant to actually establish what they were convicted of, because there is no record of it. And that allows the district court to look into those records. We've seen old jury verdict forms that list out what the actual statute was they were convicted of, but that is nowhere else accessible to attorneys or to our clients who are in custody for the rest of their lives sometimes. So,
and then continuing to walk through this statute, subdivision 6 would seem to support your position, because if under, if there's a determination that the preliminary application shows a reasonable probability that the applicant's entitled to relief, the applicant gets to file the petition. Then at the petition stage, the petition may contain any other relevant information, including police reports, trial transcripts, plea transcripts involving the petitioner or any other person investigated for, charged with, or convicted of a crime arising, et cetera, et cetera. So it does seem to suggest that once you get to the petition stage, that's when you start looking at the facts of the crime.
That's right. And if you look at the original, what the legislature's intent was, all of these cases were supposed to go to Ramsey County, and mm-hmm. they were maybe supposed to even have some individual who's in charge of all of these. And there would have been no ability for them to have the time to dig through facts of every single one of these cases and make all of these factual determinations regarding whether somebody was a major participant or acted with extreme indifference to human life. After the preliminary application phase, then it was supposed to go to the county of conviction, where a judge in that county would get the petition, would get all of the documents supporting the petition. Then there would be an evidentiary hearing, which we've held many of these across the state, where we walk into the courtroom and we can challenge evidence, we can bring in testimony, we can make specific arguments regarding those factors.
So the preliminary application, in your view, is really meant to just be an administrative function?
That's right.
Somebody needs to make sure the person's still in custody and they were actually convicted of an offense that entitles them to seek this relief.
That's right, because otherwise it would become way too burdensome if individuals convicted of not even murder crimes or not aid and abetting offenses were filing these petitions all over the state of Minnesota. So this was a way for the legislature to filter out individuals who did not have a reasonable probability of obtaining relief.
Because they weren't convicted of the necessary offense.
That's right. And and we've also seen cases where they accidentally granted an application, and then once we get to the petition phase, have denied it because the individual wasn't originally convicted under the right statute or was not in custody.
Let me ask you this, just because it's interesting to me, since this is new to me. Why the requirement that the person be in custody? Because whether you're in custody or out of custody, you still have an aiding and abetting conviction on your record. Are you not allowed to seek to have that conviction removed simply because you've served your sentence? How does that work?
So what the legislature determined is if somebody is in custody or on supervised release. So they can technically be out of custody but still be under supervision.
Well, what if you're past probation and you just don't want to have, you know, aiding and abetting felony murder on your record anymore?
Yeah, that's a policy determination that the legislature made to make some sort of cutoff that if somebody is no longer on supervised release or in custody, then they cannot file an application.
What do you make of the language in this is subdivision 5C about reasonable probability, that it says the court shall determine whether in the discretion of that judge there's a reasonable probability. If it's just looking at specific factors and are these things present in this application or not, what's the discretion of the judge?
Yeah, so it kind of goes back to what I was explaining earlier, is that there are some cases where the judge cannot conclusively say whether somebody was convicted under the right statute, accomplice liability, because it is an older case. So in those situations, the courts have, in their discretion, granted the preliminary application. Then we've gotten to the petition phase. We filed our documents. And at that point, if the court determines under, I believe it's subdivision 7, that there was not a reasonable probability, then it can summarily deny it at that point. So to get back to your question, the discretion is whether this person was convicted of under the right statute. And in some cases, it's not completely clear, and the court then has discretion to grant the application to move it to the petition.
When would it be appropriate for a court to deny the application if it's not clear?
Well, I think that would be under the court's discretion if they looked at an old...
We're not going to open this case back up?
I think it would be... We've looked at the records, and there's nothing that indicates this person was an accomplice. I found somewhere in the complaint or some other document that this person was the shooter and was not convicted under 60905.
And that determination is being made under the discretion of the judge at the preliminary application stage?
So whether they were convicted under accomplice liability, yes. Because under the preliminary application phase, there's two things that have to be proven, or three things that have to be proven. Or not proven, but...
Okay, so I'm just trying to understand the example you gave. So if it's preliminary application stage, the judge kind of looks through the complaint and everything and says, well, the complaint alleges he was the shooter. Mm-hmm. So it's like this isn't aiding and abetting. He was the shooter. So deny based on the complaint?
So I would look at it a little differently.
Okay.
If the complaint says the individual was convicted, or not the complaint, but
judgment of conviction.
Let's say look at the PSI, because that's something that the applicant can submit, is the complaint and the PSI. So let's say the PSI says he was convicted under 60905, which is accomplice liability. At that point, that is enough to move it to the second, to the petition phase. If there's an allegation that he was maybe the shooter, that's something we would litigate when the petition is filed.
Well, but, I'm not understanding the example of, I mean, just following up on my colleague's question, if it's so simple, I mean, what discretion is there? You're just saying there are situations where you don't know what the person was convicted of because it's an old case and we don't have adequate records.
That's right.
And a judge could decide to let it go forward.
That's right. And there are cases where the individual, so there's two different things. There's the facts of the case, and then there's what statute the individual is convicted under. So let's say in Judge Bentley's example, the individual was not, there's nothing in the record that we've submitted that indicates the individual was convicted under 60905. It doesn't say 60905. It just says 609.185 for a first-degree murder and for second degree and 609.19.
Because I think, well, does aiding and abetting always have to be charged or no? Or am I thinking attempts don't have to be charged separately?
I mean, that's something that may need to be litigated in some of these cases,
right?
Because it is...
I thought we had case law on that like you go to trial, I charge you with, you know, second degree assault, and then at the end the state says, well, I want to ask for attempt as well, and I think the case law says, well, you don't have to separately charge attempt. It's always in there. Is it the same for aiding and abetting or probably not?
I think you have to. Do you have to charge it out?
You have to charge it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Counsel, I'm going to go back because you mentioned the PSI as a record.
Mm-hmm.
And here, of course, Judge Castro looked at the other PSI.
Mm-hmm.
That's a judicial record, correct?
That's correct.
Right. I take it there isn't a whole lot of case law on this right now.
There's nothing. This is it.
So when we talk about reason probability, Judge Castro reads the other PSI, sees that the co-defendant said that he's the one who gave him the gun, et cetera, et cetera. Your position is... he's not allowed to make a decision within his discretion that there's not a reasonable probability of success because he just read that this guy provided the gun and that makes him a major participant. And you're saying no, he has a right to a hearing at that point.
That's right. So any issue...
And why, if he has so much discretion?
Yeah, well, a couple things. Under the plain... So judge, when you say a judge has discretion, that discretion does not mean that they don't have to follow the law. Right? They have discretion under this statute. So if there's another PSI that says that my client gave him the gun, at this stage, we are not litigating factual issues. We are not litigating credibility of that witness who has never testified in court. I've never had the opportunity to cross-examine him about that statement.
Okay, I understand what you're saying, but let me stop for a minute and say, now you're the judge and you're looking at reasonable probability. What are you allowed to consider?
The judge... that's fine if he considered that other PSI, but what he could consider that for was only to determine what Mr. Kimbrough was convicted of, right? If there was a question in this case...
It doesn't seem like what the statute says. It says... it says... whether in the discretion of the judge there's a reasonable probability that the application is entitled to relief under this section. Entitled to relief sounds like it includes... not just the statutory basis or what the conviction was under, but it seems like whether you're entitled to relief would mean you're also not a major participant and you also didn't act with extreme indifference. So why couldn't it seems like you're reading it narrowly such that the discretion is only with respect to was the defendant convicted of this offense, but not to the relief.
That's right, and I am reading it that way for a few reasons. One is, if you go to Subdivision 1, which is the purpose of the statute, which is what I started with, it is to allow anyone convicted of aiding and abetting felony murder who is in custody is entitled to petition the court for relief. right? So that's my first basis, is if you were to say that they have discretion to make rulings on major participant and extreme indifference, that would directly conflict with the legislature's stated intent.
But let me stop you, because I hear what you're saying about entitled to petition. I mean, I think you're reading that to mean what it says. Everybody gets to file a petition, but that's not true. You only get to file a petition if you meet the requirements of the preliminary application in Subdivision 4, and in which case you don't get to file a petition. So, you know, I get that Subdivision 1 says is entitled to petition, but then the statute goes on to set forth all these hurdles and requirements, which, if not met, means you don't get a petition.
Well, let me take a step back. I see my time's dwindling.
And I want to follow up on Judge Bentley's question, because I think I might be seeing a reason why I'm now disagreeing with you. One of the requirements for the preliminary application is a brief statement, not to exceed 3,000 words, explaining why the applicant is entitled to relief under this section from a conviction for the death of a human being caused by another. Doesn't that language, entitled to relief under this section from a conviction, kind of go to the ultimate relief, which is I want my conviction set aside? And the statute's requiring some sort of statement regarding why your conviction should be set aside. To get your conviction set aside, you'd have to be successful on a petition, which means you'd have to show you're not a major participant, et cetera, et cetera. So the requirements of the preliminary application do seem to invite consideration of the ultimate basis for relief from conviction. So wouldn't that inform our determination of what reasonable probability means? In other words, you're saying reasonable probability means, well, as long as you're in custody and you've got the conviction, there's a reasonable probability of relief. Well, if we look at the requirements of the application and those requirements set forth the need for an explanation of why your conviction should be set aside, no one gets their conviction set aside just because they're in custody and they were convicted of aiding and abetting. They have to show additional things. So why wouldn't we look at the statute and say, given the requirement in sub 4A6, the district court does get to look at the ultimate question of substantive relief in the form of setting aside the conviction and not just whether or not you're entitled to go before the court in the first instance?
A handful of reasons. First, under this statute, under this subdivision, the applicant has no ability to present evidence to the court.
Right, but he have an ability to submit a statement not exceeding 3,000 words explaining why the applicant is entitled to relief. For example, my recollection of the record may be incorrect, but in reading, he submitted the first application with a statement saying, here's why I'm entitled to relief. Judge Castro said, denied. I looked at the PSI. The PSI from the other guy says, you're the one who gave the gun. And plus, there was a warrant execution. We found a gun, and I think the ammunition from that gun matched the gun that was used in the shooting. So that sort of corroborates what otherwise might be a self-serving statement of a co-defendant. Preliminary application denied. Then your client gets another shot at it because of the change in the statute, submits another statement, knowing that Judge Castro denied the first preliminary application based on this co-defendant statement, and yet the second statement explaining why your client was entitled to relief didn't say, I didn't have the gun. Here's where the gun came. I mean, he offered nothing to refute that. So, I mean, it does seem to me, I guess my point is, that was very long-winded, is there is a way for a person, even though they're not presenting evidence, to plead their case. Look, it's sort of like a post-conviction proceeding. Well, actually, I think we treat it like a post-conviction proceeding. You go to the post-conviction court, you need to file some sort of affidavit saying, you know, if you give me a hearing, here's what I'm going to show, and here's why I'm likely to win. Isn't that the purpose of this brief statement, to at least tell the judge that there is some evidence out there which can be presented which might cause this conviction to be set aside? And in this case, your client didn't do that, even though he knew full well why his application had been denied in the first place.
A couple things. So just a procedural background of this case. Mr. Kimbrough was represented by a different attorney. They filled out the judicial form that was approved by the judicial branch. That form states all you have to do is check a box.
That form's inaccurate, 100%.
Okay, so that's the form that they filled out. They denied the application. At that point, the law was different. You only had to, you had to prove both. Yep, so they changed the law.
So then I
was appointed to represent him, and we filed a preliminary application where we pled his case. If you look at our preliminary application, it explains why we are in, he was entitled to relief. If you look at it as a post-conviction petition, it does exactly what a post-conviction petition does. Take the fact, if that's how we're going to look at it, it's a written memorandum. It's not the form that we submitted in this case.
Right. But what did you say in that memorandum that would lead Judge Castro to think that if he granted the preliminary application and this went to a petition stage, there would be any evidence to cause the conviction to be set aside?
So here's what we do in these cases. We file the preliminary application. The court grants the application. We file a petition. With the petition, we can submit evidence. We cannot submit evidence with the preliminary application. There is no ability to do it. It's a complaint, and it's a portion of the PSI. In every petition we've filed, we submit affidavits. We submit what we're going to introduce at a hearing. We would call him in, his co-defendant, and we would cross-examine him, and we would ask him questions about that. And we would establish by a preponderance of the evidence that our client was not a major participant and did not act with extreme indifference to human life. We have no burden to prove.
But even though you can't submit, and you're right, the petition can include police reports, transcripts, plea transcripts, et cetera. Even though you can't submit all of that with your preliminary application, what prevents you from, in your statement, saying, if allowed to petition, here's the type of evidence we would set forth with our petition?
A couple reasons. One is we submitted our argument. We pled why he is entitled to relief, because his statement under oath was that he didn't have a gun, he didn't kill anybody, he was not...
He had his plea colloquy.
Yes.
He said, I did not have a gun. I thought there was no... I thought he did not admit that he had a gun. That's very different than saying he testified under oath that he did not have a gun.
That's correct. That's correct. But we have pled enough to establish that he was not a major participant and he did not act with extreme indifference to human life.
Or if not establish, just pled that there's a reasonable probability that he was not the major participant or acted with extreme indifference, right?
Say it again.
You don't need to have established
No.
that he wasn't. You're just saying there's a reasonable probability based on what you included in the application that he was not the major.
That's correct. And if you look at the petition standard, it's a preponderance of the evidence. That's at the petition. That's a low standard. Reasonable probability is much lower than that. And if I could just conclude by saying, in the subdivision regarding the preliminary application, it doesn't say we have to do anything. Is if the court finds that there is a reasonable probability. Contrast that to the petition part where it says the petitioner has to establish by a preponderance of the evidence. That's different language that the legislature used for each section. So that establishes that we don't have to prove anything in the preliminary application phase. It is just that he was convicted under the right statute and that he is in custody, and then we can do the petition and present evidence and challenge the state's evidence. And also the state didn't even have the opportunity to respond in the preliminary application. So we couldn't even respond to the court's order. I'll respond during rebuttal, I guess. Thanks.
Very good. Thank you. Appearing on behalf of the state.
I am going to have to move this down.
Oh, please. Take your time.
Thanks. May it please the court, counsel, Michelle Montero, Assistant Ramsey County Attorney for the state, representing appellant state in this matter. I'll start out by saying that all parties are learning our way with this statute as we proceed with the cases. I've been handling the cases for Ramsey County. That's why I'm handling this appeal here today. I'm not in the appeals unit. But the petitioners, the state, the courts, we're all just making our way. And from what I can tell, this is probably, there's no case law on this issue, on the merits of an issue like this. And I'm hoping the court can provide us some guidance going forward on how we should all handle these cases in the future. Our position is that the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying the preliminary application, and we respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's ruling. The case involves appellant masterminding a purported drug transaction.
Counsel, we're going to take you right to the statute, I think, because we're aware of the facts.
Okay.
I'll start where I started with opposing counsel. To Betsy. Sub 5, parent 3, which requires the district court, when reviewing a preliminary application, to determine whether there's a reasonable probability that the applicant is entitled to relief. What does reasonable probability mean in that line?
Well, it's not defined, obviously. There's no definition of reasonable probability.
And I guess that what we're I'm seeing this dispute is coming down to, does reasonable probability mean solely that the applicant's in custody under supervised relief and has a necessary conviction, or does it take you to the merits of the ultimate decision, as might be suggested by the requirement of a brief statement why the applicant is entitled to relief from a conviction? Because you're right, we're all making our way. The statute talks about, are you entitled to a preliminary application? Are you entitled to a petition? Are you entitled to relief in the form of vacating a conviction? When we start talking about relief from a conviction, does that go beyond just offense of conviction and custody status?
Our reading of the statute is that the court should make a determination as to whether there's a reasonable probability that the application is entitled to relief under the section. And what that means is this entire section. So our position is that the court rightfully considered whether or not the individual was a major participant who acted with extreme indifference to human life in making this determination. I think appellant's argument that the district court is only permitted to filter out applicants who are not convicted of felony murder as an accomplice or who are not in custody fails. It's contrary to the plain language of the statute and I think what the legislature intended here.
Let me ask this, and I hope you understand, oftentimes the best arguments are more of a conversation. I'm thinking to myself of a situation where the complaint alleges the applicant was the shooter. The applicant admitted in his plea petition, I was the shooter. And then if we accept appellant's position, he would still be entitled to file a petition, even though it's 100% crystal clear he was the shooter, he had the gun, he admitted it under oath. I guess I'm asking myself, why would we waste anyone's time with a petition under those circumstances? But if we accept appellant's arguments here, we would have to, because technically he was convicted of aiding and abetting and he's in custody.
That's correct, and I believe that that would create an absurd result, and that would not create what the legislature intended by creating this preliminary application process to begin with. If we accept appellant's version of how the statute should be applied, the defendant in this case, who actually did shoot the individual, would be able to have his preliminary application granted and move forward to the petition stage.
Although under the statute, it would then get dismissed at the petition stage, but you would still have, you know, resources, prosecutor's office having to respond to a petition when it's obvious that the person's not entitled to relief.
That's correct. And our position, too, is that this, in essence, you know, the legislature probably created this so not to open the floodgates. We've got hundreds of people in Ramsey County that are convicted under the felony murder statutes. Many of those people are not convicted under aiding and abetting theories and are the actual person that caused the death. Those people should not have their preliminary applications granted. And that's what we believe this statute was meant to guard against.
Let's take that, just set, you know, this point that if it's obvious from a glance at the records in this case that the defendant was the shooter, or that not the petitioner was was obviously a major participant and act with depraved indifference to life. That's one scenario, but I don't know that that's the facts of this case. So here, this was not the PSI in this petitioner's case, but a co-defendant, which you could think for any number of reasons may not be the most reliable source of information. Maybe it is, maybe it's not. We don't really know by just reading the PSI on its face. So why would it be, when the standard here is just a reasonable probability, why does it make sense that the district court can look at other judicial records and kind of decide, reading those, that this in effect, is that obvious case that we were just talking about when it seems like different here?
Sure. I look at two portions of the statute that give the court the authority to do what the court did in this particular case. First of all, I'm looking at subdivision 5C, which states that in the discretion of the judge, if there is a reasonable probability that the application is entitled to relief under this section. So when I read that under this section, what that appears to me to mean is this entire statute, section 24, liability for murder committed by another, retroactive application. I think that encompasses the entire statute, not just subdivision 5.
Okay, counsel, let me just interject for a minute. Let's say you're right about that. The court in this case had two PSIs that are judicial records. In one case, we know that it led to a plea where there was no admission of providing a gun. And then we have a PSI from someone else who said, yeah, he gave me the gun. So you have two different versions of what happened that day, and neither of them's under oath. Now, why would you not have a right to have that heard? In other words, it looks like the court chose to believe the other, the co-defendant, which conveniently leads to no hearing. But why not take it to the second step when you have a dispute of that sort and put the people under oath and have a hearing? And then if you lose, you lose. But to get rid of it in this fashion allows district courts to cherry pick what they want to find reasonable possibility. I mean, this is a little bit of a set work like a post-conviction relief, I mean, the way this is set up, you know, whether you take it initially or whether you have a hearing on it. And this is a little different language, of course, but that's what I'm left with. I mean, it does say reasonable probability, not reasonable possibility. So you are left with the court saying, is it likely that this person will succeed? Now, whether it's on all of it, as you're suggesting, or not, it still comes back to, in the facts of this case, why not a hearing?
Because, Your Honor, the court gave the district court broad discretion in making a determination whether or not to grant the preliminary application at this stage. And one thing that I will point out is if you refer to subdivision 6A, so now that gets into the formal petition. However, again, my position is subdivision 5C encompasses the entire statute, but subdivision 6A actually allows the court to consider things from co-defendants' files, including presumably the PSI.
But that's at the hearing.
It is, but it is at the actual, it's under subdivision 6, so it's under the formal petition mm-hmm. portion. But again, my reading of subdivision 5C says that the court should determine whether the application is entitled to relief under the entire section.
Let me ask you this about the term discretion in 5C. We could have the situation I described earlier, where the applicant admitted under oath that he brought the gun, he shot the gun. So it's like, obviously, he's no basis for relief. So I don't know that we'd say a judge would abuse its discretion by saying, I'm not giving you a petition or a hearing. But then we have this case where we have what could be considered a self-serving statement, unsworn, in another person's PSI. And, you know, it is buttressed by the information regarding the warrant and finding a gun that matches the gun that was used in the shooting, found in a place where appellant had been staying, which does suggest that he was the one who provided the gun. You know, maybe a judge abuses his discretion if it's just a self-serving statement in the co-defendant's PSI. You shouldn't just rely on that. But, well, if you have that and some other information that tends to buttress it, is that the sort of the discretion the judge has?
Well, I do believe the judge...
And if that's the case, I mean, could we not say, you know, it is an abuse of discretion to rely solely on a self-serving, unsworn statement by a co-defendant. How do you know that's the truth? Let's have a hearing and find out.
Well, first of all, I would say, Your Honor, is we don't know exactly what additional materials this court looked at. I mean, the court cited to the three materials in his order that he, you know, relied upon in making the decision here. But the court may have looked at the entire court files for all of these co-defendants. I think there were four co-defendants involved in this murder. That being said, the court is given a broad range of discretion. The court considered the plea. The court considered the search warrant, and the court considered the PSI statement by the co-defendant, and the court came to the conclusion that there was no reasonable probability that the appellant was entitled to relief here.
I note that in sub 5H, if the reviewing judge determines that there's not a probability that the applicant is entitled to relief, judge sends notice to the applicant, applicant's attorney. Notice must contain a brief statement explaining the reasons the reviewing judge concluded there is not a reasonable probability that the applicant is entitled to relief. So it doesn't seem to require the judge to do fact findings or explain everything, just a brief statement of why I don't think you're entitled to relief.
Correct, and here I feel that the judge went above and beyond what was required by the statute in making findings of fact and conclusions of law as to why there was not a reasonable probability that this appellant was entitled to relief.
Okay, I'm thinking about post-conviction again, and there was a time where people were coming forward with, I've got newly discovered evidence, this or that, or change of testimony, and post-conviction hearings were being denied right and left, and then the Supreme Court stepped in, and I think in a series of cases, it was pretty firm. It's like, if they allege anything that would get them over the hurdle, you give them a hearing and give them their day in court. Why wouldn't we take that approach here? In other words, if there's been some sort of allegation that, well, I'm going to present evidence that shows I didn't aid and abet or I wasn't a major player, shouldn't they get a hearing? And then, if so, would that control here where in the second application there was no affirmative statement of, I did not have a gun, I did not provide the gun? I think it just said all I have to do is show I'm in custody and I meet the conviction requirement.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that argument that that's all they have to show is that they're in custody and they meet the requirement, that's contrary to appellant's own filing, where appellant in his preliminary application laid out the facts and laid out the law as to why they were entitled to relief. So the own preliminary application goes well beyond the scope of what appellant is claiming the purpose of the preliminary petition process is. As far as the post-conviction, you know, this statute has got its own process laid out in it that's separate from, I realize that there's a new case, Griffin, that I read, and, you know, there's some likeness to the post-conviction, you know, statute. I haven't really digested exactly how that plays into this at this
point.
We're
all figuring it out.
Correct. But this particular statute, the legislature created a specific process separate from the 590, you know, chapter, as to how these petitions are, the preliminary applications and the actual petitions are to be processed. So I don't think we can say that this is identical to a post-conviction hearing or a post-conviction petition. It's separate. It's a separate process that the legislature created specifically to address these cases.
What could we say, you know, just hypothetically, could we say, you know, we see the reasons the judge gave for denying the preliminary application, reliance on the co-defendant's statement. We think it was an abuse of discretion to rely on that because it's unsworn, it's unchallenged, and, you know, this is just one where there should be a hearing.
Well, I think, I mean, obviously,
without making grand pronouncements.
Correct.
You know, what does this mean? What does that mean? Is the case that simple that it's just like, you know, it's not sworn. Self-interest, obviously. You appear much better in your PSI when you're the shooter and you say, well, I didn't even have a gun. I didn't want to have a gun. They gave me the gun. You do look better.
Your Honor, you're right. But the statute allows for broad consideration by the court. The statute, I mean, it's got
but
the
But I'm
term.
Not saying the court shouldn't have looked at that. But is it possible that we might say, well, yeah, it was fine for the district court to look at that, but given the quality of that, I hate to say evidence, it wasn't evidence, given the quality of that information, it was an abuse of discretion. Because we don't allow convictions based on co-defendants' accusation unless there's corroboration. So wouldn't that concept sort of influence us? You know, unchallenged statements of a co-defendant blaming somebody else when they're charged as well generally aren't credible. We want something else before we'll base decisions on those statements.
I don't think it is abuse of discretion for the court to have relied upon that. First of all, it's allowed by the statute, number one. But number two, this is not a trial. This is not retrying the case where the court has to prove it.
I hope you understand the distinction I'm making. I agree with you. The judge can look at any judicial records. But when assessing exercise of discretion, could we say, well, yeah, you could look at that record, but you abused your discretion by giving it so much credence under the circumstances, you should have had a hearing.
Well, we could also make that same argument, Your Honor, as to the appellant's plea. The appellant's plea, first of all, the appellant is not asked whether the appellant gave a gun to this individual. The appellant does not, you know, deny giving a gun to the individual during the plea. And plea colloquies are simply to lay out the elements of the offense. Plea colloquies are not generally considered, you know, to encompass everything that went on.
I agree with you. You can look beyond the plea colloquy.
Right. So I think if we're making that argument about the statement that the co-defendant made to the PSI writer, we can make the same argument for the plea colloquy that was made, that is not enough for the appellant to meet, you know, his burden to go forward.
Well, that's the point I was making earlier. Should an appellant have to, as a condition of their application and their statement explaining why they're entitled to relief from a conviction, should the appellant have to preview for the court what their probative evidence would look like were they allowed to petition?
Well, I think
we don't have that here.
And I think that's the purpose of the 3,000-page or 3,000-word limit where appellant lays out why they are entitled to relief.
Questions? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal? Could I ask, just because I'm curious, Mr. Erickson, does the state PD's office have a designated lawyer handling all these, and is that you?
Me.
You're our expert. Well, we're happy to have the two experts here since we are all new to this.
If I could just, your hypothetical regarding an individual who admitted that they pulled the trigger. So under the purpose of the statute, it is someone who's convicted of felony murder under a theory of liability of crimes of another. If a defendant admits under oath that they pulled the trigger, they were not convicted under a theory of liability. That would not get past the preliminary application phase. That would get denied. The question in this case it's not at all like that, even if we are to go down that road, in that there is, just by his plea, it establishes all the elements that we need to establish in a petition.
Counsel, I'm going to interrupt for a minute. Help me through here as I think about this. What kind of a hearing would take place? The petitioner comes in and said, I didn't provide the gun. Mm-hmm. You hopefully find the co-defendant. He comes in and said, yeah, he brought me the gun. Are you ended up relitigating the underlying offense? Because I'm sure that's what the district court does not want to do.
So let me just take a step back. So what this is all about is retroactive relief of the new statute, right? So we are relitigating issues under the accomplice liability statute, and that's what the legislature said we can do. So if the district court doesn't want to do that, we're still doing it.
But not the entire homicide.
That's right. It's just...
Well, so, what are the parameters?
So the law, the act does explain that you are to follow 590. So the hearing is supposed to take place as if it's a post-conviction hearing. And we've had a few of these where we've had two competing guilty pleas. One person says the other guy had the gun, and the other person says the other guy. So we go into court, and we call them as a witness, and we cross-examine them. And then we put our client on the stand, and we say, you gave this statement under oath. Is it the truth? And then the judge makes credibility determinations after cross-examination, issues an order, and determines whether we met our burden by the preponderance of the evidence. Yeah. It's not the whole case. It's very specific to the issues that are at play. And that's what the legislature allowed. It didn't say we don't want to have hearings. In fact, if you file a petition, the court is required to grant a hearing.
Okay. And so if at that hearing, if we had the hearing in this case, your client testifies under oath, I didn't bring the gun, I didn't supply the gun, I didn't handle the gun. The co-defendant comes in and says, yes, he did, he gave me the gun. And the judge said, well, I believe the co-defendant. Then we're going to defer to the district court's credibility determination. Yep. We don't have a problem. The problem here is we can't be, how do you defer to a credibility determination of this nature? Is that an abuse of discretion?
That's right. And I think the abuse of discretion is not looking at these documents. I don't have a problem with that. You can look at anything he wants. The issue is that to get past this stage, it's just whether he was convicted under the proper statute and was convicted under a theory of liability.
Let's say that it wasn't the co-defendant's PSI, but that the actual petitioner's, this is not the facts of your case, in a hypothetical world, where the petitioner's PSI is in the record and the judge looks at it and it has facts kind of similar to this. Let's say that the petitioner admits to the probation investigator, I was here and I handed the gun, mm-hmm. and I didn't care what he was going to do with it. I don't know. The facts are, it's obvious. This is the obvious case. It's under a theory of accomplice liability. It's in his PSI that's in his record. Maybe you, as an attorney, would say, oh, we're not going to file this because it seems obvious. Well, I'm just trying to say the obvious case in the record. Does the judge have a discretion under this provision to say, listen, there's no even reasonable probability here that this person's entitled to relief because the facts are so obvious under his own statements? It's not like a separate. Is there anything there?
So in that hypothetical, is the defendant convicted under a theory of, he convicted? So his guilty plea is, I didn't give him the gun?
No, what if his guilty plea was, I gave him the gun? He's charged with aiding and abetting murder, and he admits at the plea hearing, I gave him the gun. And now he comes back and says, well, I was convicted of aiding and abetting. I'm in custody. Here's my application. That's all I need to show. So now I want to have a hearing and litigate whether or not I gave him the gun, even though I've admitted under oath that I did give him the gun. Mm-hmm. Are we supposed to have a hearing?
Does a major participant get a hearing?
So I want to be careful with how I answer this question, because handing the gun, that's not it. All that is required. It is with the knowledge that it's going to be used in the crime.
So there are other facts. So let's just say the absurd example, and mm-hmm. I gave a poor example when I said he admitted being the trigger puller. Let's say he gave a factual basis at his plea that makes it uncontroverted that he knew there was a crime, he knew it was going to be committed, he helped arrange it, he provided the gun, and that very crime occurred. Why do we need to have a hearing to determine whether he was properly convicted of aiding and abetting if those are his statements under oath at his plea hearing?
Because we still have the second prong of extreme indifference to human life, right? So even
but
if
isn't
he's not...
that, that doesn't require... that's just an assessment of indisputable facts.
Well, under the statute, under the new law, it says we get a hearing. So if we...
why do you need to have a hearing? Why can't a judge look at the facts and say, yes, under case law, this is under these facts, as a matter of law, it's extreme indifference to human life? What's the point of the hearing if the facts are undisputed?
Well, for a couple reasons. We're assuming that all the facts are undisputed. There's nothing else. The hearing is not just an evidentiary hearing. It's also an opportunity for me to stand in front of the judge, make legal arguments, have an oral argument. It's not just introducing evidence. So, and I also want to be clear that under those hypotheticals, it's not just the hearing, it's the petition process, right? So even in that situation where it's very clear he was a major participant, I would still have the opportunity to file a written petition that fully explains everything and my legal arguments regarding why he didn't act with extreme indifference to human life. So it's not just preliminary application hearing, there's that middle step where we actually can litigate these issues and argue them. One other thing that's really important is that for a lot of these individuals, they are filing their own preliminary applications from prison. It's not counseled assistance when they're doing that. So they are using that judicial form, they are filling it out, and they are then submitting it to the court. And the legislature knew that was going to happen because part of the act includes how the Department of Corrections gets information to these individuals and allows them to file these applications. So if we're going to require them to include evidence, attachments, all of these things that the state thinks they need to do, or a very strong written argument that defies the purpose of the act to allow them to be counseled and file a petition where they can make these arguments. And that's why the standard is so low in the preliminary application phase. There's no other questions?
Any questions?
No.
Thank you both very much. We appreciate you're helping to educate us on these new issues. Matter submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.